feels like a plunge. So it's the second full day of practice. Maybe you've started feeling that something is settling. I was very tired last night, or all day actually, all day. And I can feel that things are slowing down, falling into places. That's one of the outcome or quality or virtue of a sesshin, to allow ourselves to settle. Coming back to who we are, someone asked me when I arrived, how was your year? And it does always feel like the summer is, feels like a, you know, we say that we, in January 1st, it feels like a beginning of a year, but also July or the summer feels like also the end of a year. We conclude something. In my case, it was an extremely rich year, and with lots of things happening, and it's so, it does feel like it's a good moment to settle, contemplate, and see what happened. In this new place that we don't know, except for Thiago, of course. Since yesterday, I was letting the Roshi's talk kind of echoing and see what came up from that. And so the thread was very much Bernie's three, what does he call that, tenets? No, that's not the tenets. Tenets? These are the tenets. The three tenets, which is Bernie Glassman's own summarized, condensed version of his understanding of what this path is about, is all about. It's good to ask ourselves, how would we express it, our fundamental teachings? He expressed it in a very concise and very powerful, you know, couple of terms. Not knowing, bearing witness, action or loving action, but how would we formulate it? One of the dimension of the Eightfold Path is speech, voice. And it's a nice way to approach it also as a, you know, how do I find my own voice in that, in this path? How do I express things? How do I speak truthfully, authentically? But that means also not repeating what someone else has said. So one of the things that came to mind with these three tenets is that it's presented as a lot of the teachings, you know, it might seem originally that it's something linear, something you do first step, second step, third step. As you know, the Eightfold Path, it seems like you go first step, second step. But obviously, it's just we need to start somewhere, and we need to. There must be a starting point when we explain things. And however, it's not necessarily, it doesn't necessarily present itself that way. And it felt to me something more, had to do more like, had to do with a circle more, or maybe a spiral more than a line. And I was thinking how when we start with this not knowing, and this is what we do on our cushion, just not knowing, observing what is going on. The fact that we do come here, we do come to the cushion, is already kind of infused with an intention of some kind. Even Alfonso, maybe your father dragged you here, but probably not. Not just that. Maybe there's something that you feel, might be interesting for me in there. Let's experiment. Let's see. And I was noticing yesterday that I think about half of us, have rakusus. And I was, and for some of us, it took a long time to get the rakusus, to get to the point of the rakusus. But also, I wonder to which extent our intentions developed, deepened, transformed, got modified over the course of the years of our practice. I'm always what could be the word? Intrigued I always notice that when I teach at these institutions and schools and people that come for the first time, it's always has to do with I need to calm down, I have a lot of anxiety, and all that. Very personal, very kind of very, very personal topics that they want to tackle, that want to deepen. And I also notice that as we practice, it tends to open up. It tends to open up to different dimensions. It tends to open up to what I call the relational or the ethical, or how we work together. And for me, these days, it also deepens also to the environment, to how we, and the discussion we had last night about how to handle a mosquito means also that we see the implications of our personal work, our inner work, how it affects the relational dimension of our existence. So seeing that in the bearing witness, in the not knowing, is already in there somewhere an intention of doing that. And we are being reminded of that by what we're singing, first thing we sing in the morning. Really grounding that. It's not just we decide to just hang around on a cushion and doing whatever. It's there's an intention that is infusing, that infuses our sitting. Atonement. Now I atone. We really just, there's something very, very powerful in there. And I hear in that also, in this I atone, this very personal intention, I hear it echoes for me just what we sing in just the relational dimension also, the how we connect. Because it's suffering that is being created, and suffering to myself, but to also others, and I include in that all living beings. Not just human beings, but living beings. And so there is in there a loving intention. It's not loving action, it's this really loving intention. I think on this, yeah, and we bear witness what would be the core intention that we want to cultivate? What is the thing that bring us here? One of the concept that is being used in our tradition is the seed of awakening, the bodhicitta, this really profound desire to awaken. We need to clarify what it means to awaken, but there's like a seed. And I really like that notion of seed also, because we don't know in what it's going to grow into. But there's something that we feel it's for us, right? It's for us to cultivate. it speaks to us. This is what we want. And to do that, there's a quality that we keep cultivating, which is being mindful. I wrote down a quote from a discourse from the ancient Pali text about that, what we do. And I was thinking, when we bear witness, what does that mean? And here, in this room, in this session, in this week, it says, and the qualities of a perfect one, of a bodhisattva, someone in that path. What is it? A perfect one's feelings of pleasure, pain, or equanimity are known to him as they arise, known to him as they are present, and known to him as they subside, as they disappear, as they fade away. So, pleasure, pain, equanimity. But it continues, his perceptions are known to him as they arise, known to him as they are present, and known to him as they subside. His thoughts are known to him as they arise, known to him as they are present, and known to him as they subside. So really just paying attention to all these layers, the pleasure, the pain, equanimity, perceptions, thoughts, knowing that for ourselves. And it's not being, it's the opposite of being just numb about it. Just, I don't care. Equanimity is not being numb. So really kind of knowing, and I always feel that just a sesshin is an endless possibility to kind of look at what is going on for us, what is known to me, but in a very detailed and precise way, so much more than in the possibilities that we have in when we carried away by life and we go from one thing to the next. And being able to really, really notice the slightest details of perceptions, sensations, thoughts, that is actually, I need my English teacher, occurring?
Occurring.
Occurring. Occurring. Occurring.
Which means?
Happening. It happens. Right? It happens. It takes place. So perceptions takes place, and sensations and feelings and thoughts, but it goes so fast usually, and because we cultivate here, because everything is so organized, so that we have that ability to be more precise in our in the cultivation of our attention. So collectedness, this is what samadhi actually means, kind of collectedness, being able to be collected, to gather our attention so that we're really able to see more clearly. So yeah, and seeing the layers of our experience and also the conditions and also, you know, what is around, seeing the, Bernie Glassman used to say, the ingredients of what constitutes our reality. Not just my own personal things, but also, yeah, what is around. I mean, we have the chance to be in a house where we can just grab some fruits because they're there, but it depends on the season. If we were to come back a different season, it would be something different. And we do that. We bring that to the kitchen and something happens in there with that particular setup. So our actions depend on that. But, and we see how complex it is to respond appropriately. And we are just the simple discussion about the mosquitoes and what do we do, and it always also, I'm always very much aware that each time I go to a retreat, you know, I either take my car, take a train, and then we have all these discussions about the environment, but then in order to come here, we need to do certain things. So it's always there's no clear-cut answer. And I'm always brought back to the fact that, you know, we have these discussions, but if we were in a tradition that had a kind of huge kind of book of rules and say, well, it's very easy, you just have to do this, probably there will be way less people attending retreats. No?
I wouldn't be here, that's
right. And that being said, there are certain Buddhist traditions, and especially, I mean, I'm thinking of the monastics, and they have all kinds of rules that really tells them how to behave in certain situations. Yet the bottom line, the basic framework is, and these guidelines, these monastic guidelines, were also made because they came one after the other. There's certainly not the Buddha who did set them up. And they were responding to certain situations, and because they were living together, and so number of rules were required. The Eightfold Path, which is our kind of our basic kind of ethical framework, is very kind of open. It doesn't. It's not specific at all. There was a passage that I like so much in this sutta. I don't know if it's a famous sutta, but it's a sutta I quote very often because I like it a lot. The suttas where the Buddha talks to the Kalamas, which was a group of people. And he says, it is fitting for you to be perplexed, fitting for you to be in doubt. Doubt has arisen in you about a perplexing matter. Come, he says, the Kalamas, but I would say, come, wildflowers. Do not go by oral tradition, by lineage of teaching, by hearsay, people, things that you heard saying, by collection of scriptures, by logical reasoning, by inferential reasoning, by reason cogitation, by the acceptance of a view after pondering it, by the seeming competence of a speaker, or because you think the ascetic is our guru. But when, wildflowers, you know for yourself these things are unwholesome, these things are blameworthy, these things are censored by the wise being me, the wise. These things, if accepted and undertaken, lead to harm and suffering. Then you should abandon them. There's so much in there. It reminds me of the perplexed aspect. Reminds me of this Jewish story that spoke to me a lot, because I felt very much in that particular situation. About this guy that doesn't know if he should spend his life studying or he has to take care of his kids and all that, and he goes and asks the rabbi what he should do because he's so perplexed. And the rabbi says, "Well, what does God want for me?" And he says, "Well, God wants you to be perplexed by that." Just that simple, you know, that simple mosquito arising in a realm of consciousness. It's like, should I kill it or not? Well, it's so great, you know, instead of looking at, okay, what does the Buddhist scripture say about killing a mosquito? And let's be perplexed about it. And acknowledging all the various dimensions of it. To be in doubt. And as we say in Zen, great doubt, great awakening, small doubt, small awakening, no doubt, no awakening. Plunging into the doubt. That means also plunging into our experience.
And maybe even celebrating that we have mosquitoes, because insects are dying all over.
Yeah, absolutely.
Celebration is not too much to ask.
Well, celebration has to do with joy, right?
Yeah.
And joy is such we've studied so many in the study group. We've studied so many texts where joy appears, and it's so great because I feel it's a virtue that is absolutely essential to look at, to consider, like not to be forgotten. That there is a lot of joy in there. And I personally feel that in the beginning of a retreat, I don't necessarily feel that joy happening a lot because it's a lot of struggle, I'm tired. But then as it goes on, the joy kind of appears. And when we talk again and we interact, and there's like a lot of joy happening. Because of that, and in a way, without us knowing it, without us necessarily being aware of it, this is one of the dimensions that we cultivate, because that goes with appreciation. You know, it goes hand to hand with appreciating, looking at the ingredients, free functioning, and then some joy actually arises from that naturally. And it's a good... I personally feel that it's a good criteria, maybe, or of a kind of spiritual achievement. How much joy is there, you know? Mm-hmm. Or is it totally kind of sad and dead? And so what is being said is also just, you know, forget about everything that comes from the outside, but just really trusting your experience of what is wholesome or unwholesome, or a sense of intuition. I mean, all that, all the reasoning and cogitation and what is being written, I think it's very can be very inspirational, very helpful, very useful, and we shouldn't discard it, but really just at the same time coming back to us, coming back to what is known to us, right? Intimately. And the noticing that something is wholesome and unwholesome, so again, that goes back to kind of this fundamental intention of what do we want. And so the loving aspect of the loving action, or the loving intention. When we hear when we sing the Meal Gatha, you know, we start by reciting the names of the Buddhas and the names of the Bodhisattvas. And we can really hear that as various dimensions of the things, the qualities, the paramitas that we're trying to cultivate. Each Bodhisattva, each name of each Bodhisattva whose name we recite is one of the dimensions of the qualities that we're trying to cultivate. Avalokiteshvara, just great compassionate, so that's kind of the embodiment of compassion. Samantabhadra, just the one who helps. Maitreya, the Buddha is yet to come. So again, we ground our practice in our intention to manifest, to cultivate, to manifest to these qualities. If we go back to what is known to us and we act on that, that really also puts us on the spot, puts us as responsible, and puts us in a position of responsibility with what we do. And what makes it complex, one of the dimensions that makes it complex, is we might be rather clear about our intentions, that is one component for the way we act, and at the same time we have no idea about the consequences of our actions. And that makes it very complicated. I think it's a big issue and an element of complexity when we think about the environment, because We try to get rid of something, thinking, yeah, this is not good, and then we don't realize that it has all kinds of implications, because it's unfathomable how everything is linked with everything else. And we have no idea, when we touch on something, we have no idea how the various impacts that it's going to create, the chain of consequences that it's that our action is going to trigger, and makes it even more complex. So we need to, we are back on square one, which is now we've acted in the, what is happening, witnessing, bearing witness. I don't know, I really don't know what the consequences of my actions will be. And yet, if we don't start with our intentions, you know, the consequences will unfold in a very different way. If we're not, if we start from a different point. Which is probably one of the core, if there's one teaching that the Buddha left us, was probably the most important one, is really about conditionality. Realizing that everything that happens is happening because of conditions, and because of that also, that allows us to move the conditions around and have different sets of results. But that puts us in the driver's seat also, as everyone, every one of us.
Can I ask?
Yeah.
There's a doubt here, great doubt, about something that yesterday was spoken. And it was not you, but you are here. It was this story about, it has to do with everything that you are saying. Suzuki Roshi hitting a Lamborghini. Mm-hmm. And I don't get it. According to what I understand, it's another dimension of, and that in some sense, he wants the student to understand to not fix himself in a position of not hitting. And I understand that, let's say, if the Kyago's mother would come with a rooster with loving kindness, please, I cook this for you. Maybe it was appropriate to hit it. But I don't get the point in going to a place. There is no vegetarian things, but there is cheese, there is salad. Why the teacher eat meat? It's not wholesome. The consequences is that a cow is killed. I don't get it.
Well,
I'm sorry. Yeah. Maybe he, by hitting the cow, since he's free, maybe the cow is free too. I don't know.
Mm. Yeah, well, the story was told for a purpose,
mm-hmm.
right? And the purpose was not well, it's okay to eat meat. I don't think that was the purpose of the story.
Yeah.
The purpose of the story was to to help the student to move in his fixed ideas.
I know, but for that you kill a cow?
Well, you know, in so many Zen stories you hit the student to help them understand.
You kill a cat,
exactly.
You understand why you kill a cat.
Right. And it can be taken as a metaphor. I mean, it's certainly not a guideline of how to behave. Just each time you meet a cat, just kill the cat. But we also have this thing, you know, if you meet the Buddha, kill the Buddha.
Yeah, we understand, but it's not to kill the Buddha. Just to...
Well, yeah, exactly. If you take it too literally, then you end up killing the Buddha. Killing the person, right? Yeah. But so the whole point is not to kill the cat, or the whole point is not to say... It was told in a very specific context.
But I understand Miguel's question, because it's the question of if the ends justify the means. If in order to help release the student from his preconceptions, we embark on eating a burger.
Yeah.
Do you see how far do we go
to release the student from the preconceptions?
Exactly, be perplexed. Yeah, there's no... Yeah, how far? That's the question. How far you go? I remember when I was in Oregon, in the Great Vow Monastery, there was a ceremony, Shuso ceremony for the person who was being the head of the monastery for a couple of months. And so there was a ceremony, so she was presenting something, and then there was questions and answers, and you had to challenge the Shuso, the student. And there was a koan about, I forgot, about a lion and who pushes the, I forgot the story, but pushes the other lions in the over the cliff and so it was really about, for me it was like how it was exactly the thing about abuse, you know, how far can a teacher go. When does it become abuse, and when is it a skillful mean, you know? And someone asked, you know, would you break a student's leg in order for him to achieve awakening or something like that, you know? Mm-hmm. How far do you go, you know?
It seems, I'm sorry, this is maybe just ignorant of my part and even arrogant. But it seems that the teacher is doing something from a perspective of ignorance. That's why I have a doubt.
Mm-hmm.
He's the teacher, so okay. I have to...
So if we go into the kind of the relative thing, also let's not forget that we are probably in the 60s or 70s when that story takes place, you know? So our whole knowledge and our whole... sensitivity around meat might be slightly different also, you know?
Well, okay. We do every day the vow of saving sentient beings.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I don't know. For me, this is still a doubt. I understand that in the absolute point of view, there's no cow. There's no difference, there's no separation. But as we chant in the identity of relative and absolute, well, the cow believes is a cow, so she suffers. So I don't get it.
Well, if you stay in the realm of the relative, not the absolute, let's forget about the absolute. You know, it's exactly what Roshi said. You know, we take antibiotics also, or we eat plants. So we took things away from the tree, you know. We took something living from the tree. And so we're starting to make, and I see the point, you know. I see the point, and we are making hierarchy. Is that good? Hierarchy. between the grass and the plants, and then the cow on top of the on that pyramid, you know. For me, what it tells me is that what whether it's you know meat or vegetables, can we appreciate that? I mean, this life that has been taken.
Yeah. Let alone the fact that the cows are very often heavily mistreated to get their milk. So for the cheese sandwich, it's pretty much as awful. Except they keep them suffering for years instead of just killing them straight away and making a burger out of it. So it's all relative.
It's all relative, exactly. No, but it's because it's all relative, and also what comes out of that. For me, it's like the. It's exactly what we sing. Can we? 72 labors brought us this food, and you know, infinite pain also brought us this food. But he got stuck into, you know, oh, cheese is okay, but meat is not okay. You know, and can we see that we're a little bit stuck there precisely because of that? Because we're starting to make hierarchy. How does it, you know? And really, I'm not talking about the absolute. I'm really, if we stay on the absolute relative level. So, can we appreciate all that? Can we appreciate the effort? Can we appreciate all those these relative elements of, you know, cow and all that? And also, if we go into the social dimension of who picked up the, not here, but who picked up the vegetables? And you know, by and... And I don't know the petrol that it required to bring these things, you know. And then we fall into the perplexity and the complexities of the of our world, and we're not going to escape it by saying he would have been okay if he had done the same exercise with another type of sandwich, you know. It would have been the you know it what makes it. I think what makes it very relevant, that story, it makes you react because you're starting to, you know, it plunges you into your own, like, yeah, but, you know, meat is really just...
No, cheese is an exploration. Most of the cases can be a bit different, I understand it. But, I don't get really the thing of inviting... kind of inviting the student to break his vow of saving sentient beings, like something like that, you know.
But you're not stopping, say, you don't stop, how can I say that?
Draw a line?
Yeah.
By eating it, you're not...
Yeah.
The intention... I understand the intention of teacher. It's just until where do you go, you know? And this point of wholesome and not wholesome.
I was very impressed. It was mind blowing when I was a teenager and we received Burmese monks at home and the Burmese community of Paris would gather in our apartment in Paris, and they would bring some food, and there were like chicken stuff and all. I was very surprised. I had assumed that they would be strictly vegetarian.
Mm-hmm.
Had assumed that.
They were Buddhists.
Yeah. They were like the guy was like the head monk of some monastery, famous monastery, and that happened several times. And I asked him, and I said, you know, had assumed that you would not eat meat. And he said, only when it's offered. And you can say, yeah, I mean, it's very hypocritical. He probably, that always happens, probably, and all that. And people could know, if they knew, they wouldn't serve and all that. But there's a teaching in there for me, in there. Just like not getting stuck. And if that is, you know, if this is what you have, this is what you have.
But here there is an intention. The monks I understand what you're saying, but the monks received an offering. Suzuki had an intention of, okay, bring it. Of course, I understand.
Yeah, he had an intention, but maybe the story is powerful because, not because of that, but because, you know, it points to someone who has, how do you make someone let go of his very strong fixed ideas about meat is bad, meat is murder, as Morrissey would say. Meat is murder. It's true, meat is murder. But, you know, and if we cling to that, how do I let someone, it's not that we should then do it, but it's about the clinging to that particular idea.
Mm-hmm. But the danger of that is that any action can become morally relative. If I prioritize self-doubt and mm-hmm. remaining through a state of unknown, then actually I don't really need to act. All I need to do is to stay in the unknown. All action can become morally relative. When you do so, you also paralyze.
Well, you'll have to do something, ultimately. You know, you can't stay. Actually, funnily enough, I think I said that in the retreat, in the previous retreat, I learned that the fact that they were doing ongoing retreats during the rain season, the kind of the primal reason for that was that during the rain season, because it was raining, all the insects and all that were coming out of the floor, so the best way not to kill anything would be just to sit still on your cushion, so that at least you kind of avoid, as much as possible, you avoid killing animals. But ultimately, we can't stay, we can't spend our life sitting on a cushion. You have to do something. There's no, you know, there's no way to go around that fact that we'll need to do something. Yeah. And the great news is that at the end of the week it will be finished. We'll have to do something. We'll have to go back to our life and work it out in a different set of circumstances, which are in a way so much more difficult to handle. You know, so much more difficult to handle when we're caught, when we don't have all this framework that makes it, we minimize pain. We minimize pain, and yet we still need to eat. And because we still need to eat, whether we eat cheese, vegetable, or cow, you know, we take life. There is no way around it. We take life.
It's not the same.
It is not the same. It's a relative world. It's not the same. Yeah, a cow and a cheese and a flower is not the same.
Yeah,
it's not the same. Absolutely. And yet we still take life. But it's not the same. Yeah. Can we recognize that and fully, and what do we make it out of it? And I think it's exactly this, like recognize it, and like, you know, it comes from the efforts of all sentient beings, and sentient beings is just also the plants, that's sentient living beings. Yeah.
My question, if a mosquito, does a mosquito has Buddha nature? That's my question. Mu is not acceptable as an answer.
What kind of students are these?
What's your true question? If the mosquito doesn't have Buddha nature, then you can kill him? Yeah.
So we had a
If you woke up and killed the Buddha.
Exactly. Well, that's what we did. Well, that's what I did. Sorry. That's definitely what I did. I laid down and I heard the mosquito. A couple of seconds after I lay down, I thought, this is not going to happen. Second night in a row. I got up, put the lights on, and then you arrived when I was already, or had already spotted the mosquitoes. And there were several, in fact, there were a lot already. So I thought, okay, this is happening now. And I entered my sort of hunter, mosquito hunter mode, and they cannot escape. Even if they move, they manage to move away from the first hit. So I kill the first one, and then the second, and then I can't remember. There's a, and then the second one, I spotted it, moved away, and then I spotted it again. And this is on the ceiling, so I had to move the furniture around to stand on it. And then I smacked the second one with my book. And suddenly there's this huge smear of blood on the... And so my immediate reaction was, oh, that's me. This is my blood there. I killed myself. But then I moved straight back to killing a third mosquito. And then I had the best night. We had a whole situation of we didn't sleep so well the night before, so you even moved out of the room to sleep. And I had the best night, but it involved killing three mosquitoes.
Can go with the cup and
it's true.
Put something and put him outside.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's true. That would have been a bit acrobatic, but I could have done it. But I didn't have a cup, and so that's what I was thinking about. I was thinking, I could have done that. I could have gone to the kitchen, found a cup, but when I heard the mosquito, it triggered a sort of instinctual killer mode, and there was no stopping me. Yeah, and I even used him as an assistant to help me. But yeah, I know what you mean.
Well, to go back to how I started, I think it's really fantastic, you know, in Sechins to be able to have the time, the leisure to ponder about these things, because usually we don't. And suddenly we're torn because we want to respect things, we want to respect life, and suddenly we plunge into these awful complexities of, there's a mosquito, what do I do? You know, and so we should enjoy this as much as possible, because it's very precious. And it goes into, and we, that allows us to also go into our fixed positions. You know, this thing is, we shouldn't do this and we shouldn't do that. And then, but what do I do? And look where it sticks for us, where it makes it very, where do we bang ourselves on the wall, you know?
So we can even kill the Buddha, but don't make a burger out of them.
Don't make a what?
A burger out of them.
A burger.
Buddha.
That remembers me a story told by Jack Kornfield. Maybe you heard about it. And it was about his teacher, Ajahn Kah, I think. So this was in, I don't know, Birmania or something like that. And there was a Buddhist teacher that was her disciple, and she was teaching somewhere, and then after, nearby him, and then after 10 years she was done, and she moved to the United States, and she started, and she became like a Mormon or something like that. And then she returned to the same monastery where she was, and she started to teach that. And all the monks, including Jack Kornfield, were like, what is happening here? She's back to the same monastery, teaching now the Mormon tradition and stuff. What is this? And so a lot of tension and conflict around that. So they decided to go talk with Ajahn Kah. And they told him, so now she's teaching this Mormon thing there. And he said, Oh, maybe she has truth.
She has the truth.
The truth.
And that was his answer. Mm-hmm. So that remembered me because he was seeing everyone really sticking to the Buddhist truth and tradition, and so he gave them this truth, this answer.
I think you're right, you know, because when you say that being here is a chance for us to take time, you know, to think about these things, because and that's exactly what happened during sessions, and that's what I think that is interesting, that because yesterday night I had my own experience with one mosquito. He was a warrior, a real warrior, but I decided to stay with him all night. But it was okay, it was fine, I did it. But that's true, because I was really thinking about that. I was like, okay, so I have to accept he's going to spend the night here, that's for sure. But that's exactly what you say, and it's all what is happening for us during this moment. And this morning when I had to, I wanted to do a bouquet I went into nature and I saw the, I don't know in English, figs. And this is so beautiful because they are very small on the branch, and I was like, wow, this is just perfect. But if I cut this, so the fig is not going to grow, and this, everything is like that, right? When we are, well, maybe in another place I wouldn't even have think about that and just cut it like this. But at the end, that's what I did with another fruit, right, with a chestnut.
Right.
But it was like, okay, this is so beautiful, and at the same time, if I do that, it's not going to grow anymore. It's like...
And I think that the common thread in all that, whether it's a mosquito or that, is like basically the sense of appreciation for life that occurs because we pay attention. And so again, this is kind of the bodhicitta, or the ethical intention that underlies what we do, that underlies even this first step of not knowing. It's like, really, we want to appreciate, or we end up appreciating because we pay attention. We open our eyes and we start to look at things, and then it's like, yeah, we can appreciate. We can appreciate the work. We can appreciate nature. We can appreciate the interdependence of things. We can appreciate what is given. And then we fall into perplexities of, should I cut it? Should I kill it? Should I? Because it's all part of, I'm just part of that, and I appreciate all things, even like a mosquito. And yet, also, it has other implications, and it that makes us, then we cannot just say, I'm not doing anything, or even just, okay, there was a book by Pascal Bruckner, and it was in India, and the character is like, is thrown into a cell, and he let himself basically be covered by insects and all that, like kind of offering himself, you know. the character ends up almost dying because of that. That's an option, but that also has consequences, you know. So what do we do? And
she had the best path about the mosquito. She had the best.
It's no doubt that when you want to
better path than our path.
but yeah. I have traces of that. This is the night I spent with him, right? So it's
love bites. Love bites.
Yeah, José Eduardo.
I was just saying that it is true when you want to stick to the vows.
it kind of rises some kind of anguish, supplement anguish, and that is not also something also I would say that you start fighting with yourself all the time. I know what you mean. I mean, I went through a lot of experiences like that, and I don't know. It's what you say. Sometimes, perhaps, the option you have, if you are not, for instance, if you are with kids, I had that experience with my children. So I was trying to protect them in a way. If I would be alone, perhaps I would have saved the mosquito, but it were babies and all that. So the things that is what you say, perplexity, is this continuous acknowledgement of the mystery of life that leads us to act with the deepest awareness one can have at one moment and try really to hard the list, I would say like that. But to be fixed, that is the problem with all kinds of norms, I would say. And you start by saying the rules in monasteries. Right? Yeah, those rules, they have been meant because they are necessary, of course. For people who live together without rules and be completely chaotic, you would end up in some kind of cult where everything is permitted. So the rules are needed, but even the monastic rules, they are quite flexible.
Mm.
It's not like what people make it. You see, you have a few guidelines, but then there is always, well, I read the Benedictine rule, and for a while I was in this monastery just for a few days, and I saw that there were people that were very fixed to it, whereas there were other people that were a little bit more flexible. But that is to say that, I mean, yeah, when you say, yeah, I don't see the, in fact, my understanding of this story with Suzuki. It was not advocating to eat. I mean, for me it's quite clear. It was not even advocating the guy to break his vows. His purpose was different. His purpose, I think, is what you said is mm-hmm. like he wanted to lead this student not to be completely blocked by a fixed idea what a vow is. Okay. That's my interpretation. Of course, vows are I think I already talked with you about this. The problem with me is intention. That is, intention is something that perhaps can block us. Because intention means something that you also have it as a priority or something. So in the Zen tradition, you talk a lot non-intention. See, but that is perhaps another talk. I would say that the intention is perhaps a deep wish that things go the way that your awareness thinks is the best way.
Mm.
Okay.
I was just going to say there are 2 minutes left until official lunchtime. One minute left.
We'll stop here. All right. Thank you.